Hello. So it was January 19, 2011. I was a full-time case manager for a supported housing agency that serviced the severe and persistent mentally ill by giving them housing subsidy. And in turn, we also provided case management to make sure they were doing well in the community. And a small cohort of our people came directly from inpatient institutions, like psychiatric facility. I'm not talking about a hospital, but inpatient psych, state hospital. And it was an experiment, I guess, if you will. But one of my clients, his name was Jamile. I got him from the very beginning. So I did the whole admission process with him and everything. We grew really, really close. I really cared for him. I got to know his family. He had an ICM team. For those of you who might not know, that's intensive case management that helped you in the community to make sure you stay engaged with your behavioral health. So on this particular day, we were going to have an intervention because Jamile started decompensating quite significantly in the preceding months. And what I'm talking about, he was walking around being menacing. People in the building were scared of him. So part of my job as a case manager was I had to go see them at least twice a month and have some collateral contact. And because of his escalating behaviors, we decided to have an intervention in his apartment. And his ICM team would be there, my supervisor, our aide, and myself. And the night before, there was a huge snowstorm. This is Westchester County, New York, about 30 miles north of the city. And we get a lot of snow up there. And so the ICM facility, they closed down for the day because of the snowstorm. And so my supervisor was like, you know what, just go over there, knock out this inspection, and you'll go there with the aide. So I was a little reluctant, but I was like, you know, this is my job. And so I had to shovel the car out of the snow. And as I was warming it up, our aide, Miguel, he comes and tells me, listen, they're going to need me in Staten Island. I can't go with you. And I said, okay. So the supervisor comes and goes, just go knock out this inspection. Our numbers were really low because it was like the fifth snowstorm, like, in a row in like 2 weeks, and we got funded, and so we had to provide numbers. So I get to Jamile's apartment, and I knock on the door, and I hear him, he comes to the door, but he doesn't open it, and he says, are you alone? I said, he asked who's with me. I said, I'm alone. He was like, okay, I'll be just a second. And I hear his footsteps going away from the door, not unlocking it, and then he turns up the music, and then he comes back to the door. He lets me in, and I walk inside, and I had my little clipboard, you know, my little check-off things. I have to check the room, the refrigerator. Like, it's a check-off thing, literally. So he says, like, I really have to show you something. Like, I'm like, okay. And he gestures to the bedroom, and so I go to the bedroom, and he stands in the doorway, and at this moment, I don't know how to explain it, but in my head, time is frozen for me. And I realize I'm like a caged animal. There's nowhere for me to move because he's blocking the doorway. And when we're talking about 6'4", 320-pound, decompensated person with schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder that has not been taking his meds and has not gone to psych. And we were there for this intervention. And I'm by myself. And in my head, I knew, I don't know how to tell you, but it's like I felt these prickly sensations from the bottom of my toes to the top of my head all over my body. And I knew I was in trouble. And in my head, I was trying to think of a way out. Think of an exit, and I was 10 stories up, so I couldn't go out the window, and I couldn't push him. I'm 47 years old at the time. I'm 5'2", and I weighed about 140 pounds back then, a little lighter, but he points to a hole in the wall, and I repeat what he says just to buy my brain some time, because everything is happening now. Everything is now. And he repeats, I repeat back, and all of a sudden I feel this crashing sensation down my face, and I scream fire. That's from a training I had years earlier. That you scream fire, people come running because they don't want to get burned. But if you yell help, they're afraid. And I remember that somehow. And so I screamed fire at least once, I think. And then I'm like yelling, like a gut-wrenching scream that I didn't even recognize I could do. And I was terrified. The amount of terror, I can't even describe. Like, think of the worst, scariest movie you've ever seen. 10 times scarier than that. And I knew I was in trouble, and he just starts pounding me, just pounding and hitting me and hitting me. And I fall to the ground quite fast. It just took seconds, it seems like. And I am on the ground, and there's just blood everywhere. I could see it, I could smell it, I could taste it. It was just all around me. And I couldn't breathe, and I couldn't see, and I'm thinking, am I this weak? You know, what's wrong with me? And he just kept on hitting me, and I was... All of a sudden, it was just like I was above my body, and I was trying to communicate with my body, but it wasn't happening. And at that terror, I thought to myself in that moment, oh my God, you've abandoned me. This is the most scared I've ever been, and I'm alone. And in that moment, I just felt like I was supported in love, and in that moment, I was supported, I was loved, I was heard, I was comforted, and I had no pain, none. And I was in and out of consciousness, and I heard him on the phone, and he had just called the police, and he said, I killed my social worker. I wasn't a social worker yet, I was a caseworker, and I was in social work school. But anyway, I was in and out of consciousness. Next thing I know, the police are at the door, and I could hear them knocking, and I could hear the rush of people. And before I know it, this EMS person, and she's at my side, and I thought, oh my God, this is my angel. She's here to help me. And she's talking to me the whole time. She's talking and talking, and she's asking me to stay awake. And I just wanted to go to sleep because where I was at before was so beautiful, and it was comforting. And in the place where I opened my eyes, it was very scary and chaotic. I couldn't see, I couldn't breathe, and I didn't know what was going on. And so they take me in the ambulance the whole time she's talking to me. I remember them whisking me through a corridor, and I think I was in the trauma room. It was bright lights, and I could feel people tugging at me. It felt very intrusive. I could feel poking and stuff, but never any pain. And then I drifted off again through this like tunnel. It's the best description I can have. And it seemed like I'd been going through revisions of my life, and all I could see is multiple of souls as far as the eye could see. And everybody was like welcoming me. And I know not everybody's belief is, you know, the same as mine. So however you wanted to, I'm not here to explain that. I'm just telling you my what I experienced. And I remember at one point I get to one stage, and I'm given a choice. And the choice is to stay in this beautiful, wonderful place that you don't feel any pain, any sorrow, anything. And it's all acceptance. It's all love. It's beautiful. I can't even describe it. There are colors beyond words. And it's just a being beyond words. It's just like you communicate with your mind, but it's not telepathy. I don't know how to explain it. But I kept coming in and out of consciousness, and it was... My brain was not working right. Next thing I know, I'm zapped back, and I'm in this hospital room in four-point restraints. I can't move. My legs are, I can't feel my legs. My hands are in splints. There's a tube in my mouth and machines whirring, and I hear people talking, and I think my eyes are open, but nobody seems to notice. And they're very sad, and they're talking like I'm dead. And I thought, I'm right here, I'm alive. And little by little, I get better, and they take things off of me. And at one point, my treatment team takes me into a room, and everyone's in there, and my daughter, my son-in-law. And the doctor asked me, do you remember what happened to you? And I was like, yeah, my client beat the crap out of me, you know? And they were like, do you remember a weapon? And I said, no. And they said, well, there was a knife. You've been stabbed multiple times. And they asked if I could remember that, and I was like, I can't. About an hour later, the DA comes over, and it's really important that I remember this knife. And they show me this picture of this knife that's like the biggest one you use, like during the holidays, you know? You only take it out like twice a year. And I see different angles of this knife in different ways, and I'm blank. And I was like, my brain isn't working. I don't recognize a weapon. I remember seeing something shiny, but I clearly did not see a knife. So what happened was the first stab came like from the top of my head down to my chin, into my eye, into my mouth, down my chin, one got my earlobe. My lung was punctured. My diaphragm had to be reconstructed. I guess when I was on the ground, I put my hands over my head, and so the backs of my hands were ruined. And at one point, I must have put my hands up defensively, so the knife sliced both my all my fingers and my hands, and my nerves, like, things were severed, or, you know, like, so I had to have reconstruction for that. So I was in splints for many, many months to come, way after discharge. After the hospital stay, I went to rehab, and it was at rehab where my nurse and the physical therapist asked me, have you seen yourself? And I said, no. So they said, we're going to show you yourself. And they kind of had people ready because they thought I was going to have this meltdown. And so they were ready to do an intervention. And so they walked me to the mirror. And I look in the mirror, and I start laughing, like uncontrollably laughing, and I don't know why. I think I could. I looked quite ridiculous. There was just scars everywhere, dried blood. My eyes were barely open, popped blood vessels all throughout my face. And I, you know, I have a lumpy head now from the scars, but and I just laughed because I didn't believe the person I was looking at was me. I really didn't believe it at first, and it took a while. I never cried looking at myself. It never affected me that way. I had some great surgeons that I think did a great job. I look pretty close to the way I used to. I had a special, I had an occupational therapist that specialized in hand therapy, and with many, many months of therapy, I healed, you know, and eventually I got to go back to school. I didn't go back that semester. They didn't allow me to. They said, no, you can't come. I wanted to. I was like, that. The following week I was supposed to start classes, actually. And the professor came to see me, and she was like, you can't start. I'm sorry, you just can't. Anyway, you know, the healing process took a really long time, months to years. I've had to have multiple surgeries even after discharge. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't, you know, it's been 13 years and 10 months of life that I've gained because there were all of these professionals, these healthcare professionals, these angels that I call them, that took quick action and were able to save me. I had a choice, but they were the ones doing the work. And I don't know how many doctors and surgeons and physical therapists, SLP, OT, I hope I don't miss anyone, but, and the amount of nurses that probably took care of me in the interim, you know, from start to finish, probably hundreds. I don't know. It was a long time. It was a long recovery. So for all of you healthcare professionals on this stage and out there in the audience, if you've never heard the words from patients because they never got to see you, I want to thank you for the work you do because it's so important. You know, it you save lives. It didn't just affect me, but my children, my grandchildren. Since then, I've gained 6 grandchildren, a new son-in-law, a new daughter-in-law. Like, things happen to us, and we just keep going because that's what we do. So just thank you very much for the work you do. I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Francis, for taking us to heaven and for coming back. And can you, like, just try to imagine a little bit of the grit it takes to, like, keep going in school when something like that happens? She was stabbed
28 times.
28 times.
And still finished social work school.
Because...
A couple weeks ago, we were Francis and I. We were called into a trauma at the hospital. Francis was called in as social work because we knew it was going straight to palliation, and so they wanted her there. And for all of her work at the hospital over these years, this was the first time she had been asked to be present at the arrival of a trauma alert. And afterwards, she came to me and she said, "There were all of those hands on that body, and there were all of those voices in that room. And I remember that. I know now what that was." And she finally saw it for the first time from the outside. Francis has been a travel social worker for us, and there are 2 days left on her contract. Let's give it up for Francis for being here.
The American Hospital Association put out a paper in June of this year that 76% of healthcare workers have experienced violence in the workplace. You may think I'm negative, but I don't believe your employer is there to keep you safe. I think it's a business model, and I don't think there's ever going to be the staff or the stuff to keep you safe. But you know what's there is that gut feeling and those hairs that are standing up on the back of your neck. Do your best to keep yourself safe out there.
So with that, we have reached the first half of our show. We are going to pause for intermission, and your gut might be telling you that you need more nachos, and that is also a very valid message from your gut. You know, we do this show for entertainment, absolutely, absolutely. But even more than that, Jennifer and I do this for the connection and among the community of nurses and medical staff. Again, we're so cynical, right? But our employers really do benefit from us being fractured, from us being separated by location and by shift, or by not having the time or energy to come together and talk about what this job is really like and what changes might look like. So please make some friends, form a union. We ride at dawn.
Do all that in 15 minutes. And someone needs to buy Monica a margarita.
We'll see you in 15. Thanks,
guys.
Thank
you.